one more moment. Today's really shooting from the hip.
Pew pew.
You save that one for the blooper reel.
All right, for sure. All right.
Hello, and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teenie.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is about our favorite thing in the whole world.
Alcoholic beverages. So today we're going to be talking about the greatest state in the nation, and that is the Lone Star State. That's right, Texas, y'all.
Texas. And while I could spend this entire episode talking about the rolling plains and the robust sage bushes and lavender rows and wide blue skies of our amazing yet humble state. Today, the best place in the world. Today we'll be focusing on our great state's colorful history and beer and wine, the important regions within Texas, and through the history wrought there, what current laws and regulations are in place.
Awesome.
In Texas.
Yeah. So Texas is obviously where we're from. We're based in Dallas, just in case you forgot. And we are very proud of our Lone Star State. So for this today, we brought some special beverages. Laura, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Well, I have today a Cabernet Sauvignon from Becker Vineyards. And Becker is located in Fredericksburg, which is in the Texas Hill Country. Talk about both of those a little later, but I thought Fredericksburg was so interesting because it's a really popular destination in Texas. All the hip young people and grandparents alike are traveling there for the wine trails.
Yeah, lots of bachelorette parties, lots of retired couples.
It's
been referred to as the hotspot destination for wine drinking in Dallas or in Texas.
Yeah, it totally, I believe, lives up to that. And that's located, the AVA is located inside of a larger one called Texas Hill Country.
And remind me, what does AVA stand for?
That is the American Viticultural Area. Viticultural Area.
So this is like a vineyard that's like licensed in the United States.
Yeah, it's like a domain, like the DOC or DOG or, you know, the European designations of like borders and things like that. That is the American regions.
Great.
Yeah. Well, what about you, girl? What you drinking?
What you drinking?
Yeah. For this Texas episode, I thought I would go with something uniquely Texas. So I knew I wanted to get a bottle from Jester King Brewing Company or
awesome.
Jester King Brewery in the Hill Country of Austin as well.
Oh, Hill Country.
So this is going to be a little bit west of Austin. Technically, the address is in Austin, but it's more closer to Dripping Springs, which is also a hot spot in the Hill Country for booze. But
yeah,
Jester King is really cool because all of what they do, and you met Jeff in the last episode, the founder. So what they do is 100% spontaneous fermentation.
Oh,
so what it means is they'll brew a whole batch of beer, and then they keep it in this open-air container called a cool ship.
Mm.
It's been described to me before as like a metal kiddie pool. And they put it on the top floor of their brewery. It's in this beautiful, like, barn on this majestic hill.
Ooh.
And they leave the windows open. So instead of introducing yeast, they just leave the windows open and let the wild yeast from the hill country inoculate and ferment the beer.
Oh, that's so interesting. Like, oh, that's so cool. Wild
yeah, it's like the one brewery in Texas I point to that has, like, that sort of, like, genuine terroir. And actually, where they're located, they just bought up several hundred acres, I think more than 500 acres. They are planting a vineyard. They have goats. They're growing all sorts of herbs and fruits to put in their beers, and really interesting. So this beer, actually, it's called Kvass. Well, it's spelled Kvass, K-V-A-S-S. I'm not exactly sure how that's pronounced.
Yeah.
But this beer is unique. It is a farmhouse ale. That's what they call all of their beers.
Mm.
Because the spontaneous fermentation, they're literally on a farm. This beer was brewed with 300 pounds of Mitch rye bread from a place in Austin called Mitch Bread. 300 pounds of rye bread baked by that place in Austin, and they threw that in the brew. So this is definitely not a beer you can have, but it's really good. The yeast character gives it a really sort of funky flavor, earthy. It's tart, so it's a little sour. On the nose, it's got a really, like, rustic smell, as if you were, like, walking into a barnyard type
of area. Yeah, barnyard is exactly what I was going to say. Let me take a whiff.
Mm-hmm. And then it's, really tart up front. Finishes nice and clean, though. You get a lot of bready characteristics in the nose, as well as in sort of the mouth feel, I feel like.
Yeah.
Does bread actually make a difference in the mouthfeel? I'm not sure, but it sure tastes like it.
Very cool. Well, you can see pictures of both of these label at our Instagram account, Grapes and Grain Podcast, _ between each word.
Yep. And we're also on Facebook. You can find us there and visit our blog where we have additional contents and features. And you know you want to give us a click.
Yeah. You know you want to. Cool. Well, do you want to kick it off with the history of beer within Texas?
Yeah, sure. Now, I mentioned that Jester King is really a beer with a sense of place. Mm. The history of beer in Texas begins with the German immigrants. So the Texas State Historical Association has a whole bunch of interesting information about this, which I was really pleased about. But one fact that I found really surprising was that by the mid-19th century, Germans made up 5% of the entire Texas population.
Wow.
That's just such a large number in my head. I didn't realize it was that big.
And what year, what census was that?
So like 1850, as early as 1850.
Okay. Wow.
And then also in the 1850 census, it showed 19 brewers and distillers in Texas. So that tells you as far back as almost 200 years, people were doing this thing from the ground up.
Yeah.
So prior to 1840 or prior to that time, most of the beers in the United States were ales. They were styles brought over by the British. These are your porters, your stouts, the pale ales. But when the German immigrants in Texas around this time and throughout the United States, they wanted to express their own brewing heritage. And so what they brewed were primarily lagers. And remember, the thing about lagers is they have to be aged at a cooler temperature.
Yep.
And so the majority of Texas's breweries built during this period only made lager beer, which, since there was no artificial refrigeration,
how did they pull that off?
They only brewed during the cold months. Now, I'm sure there were many more cold months than we're experiencing now in 2018.
Yeah.
But it was really cool because they would brew it in the cool things and then they would age it. Lager is German for to age.
Mm-hmm.
So they would age it until they were ready to drink it. And the first commercial brewery is traced back to a German immigrant named William Menger. And his brewery was called Western Brewery. And it was opened in 1855 in San Antonio on the Alamo Square.
Oh.
And it was the biggest brewery at its time when it closed in 1878. Mm. So, I mean, it's really cool. Our ancestors were here and doing the thing and not letting anything get in their way. But
doing
the thing. One fact I find particularly interesting is about one of the first breweries in Dallas.
Yeah.
So it was opened by a woman.
Woohoo.
Franziska Yetzer, a badass widow.
Widows are badass, as we've learned in previous episodes. They're just doing their thing.
They're the ones really carrying tradition here.
Yeah.
So her husband died, but he always dreamt of having his own brewery.
He did. His sweet, poor little heart. Bless his heart.
So hers, the earliest sighting for an advertisement was like September 11th, 1869.
Mm.
So women in brewing in Dallas go far back.
Woohoo.
Yeah. And then we can't talk about beer history in Texas without talking about Shiner. So Shiner.
Please. That's exactly where my mind was lingering.
Really?
Yes.
So Shiner is a really old brewery. It was opened in 1909, but interestingly, it was opened by a group of Shiner-based businessmen who wanted to appeal to the German settlers that were coming. And shortly thereafter, another German immigrant named Cosmas Spetzel found out what they were doing, and he loved the idea. So he actually purchased the brewery and grew it and made it a hallmark of Texas beer. It's probably the most famous beer brand from Texas, ever.
Yeah.
Besides Lone Star, but that's a whole other thing. and then, shortly thereafter, Prohibition killed everything.
Oh, my God.
1920 to 1933.
So annoying.
But then, after 1933, it took a long time for the craft movement to come along because the only companies that could survive were basically the giant beer makers who were able to manufacture raw materials for the war.
Mm-hmm.
So it killed off all the mom and pop shops. And it took until, the late 70s for the brewing movement to really pick up. Now, what's interesting is, Texas was founded on like a culture of homebrewing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Homebrewing was not legalized after Prohibition until 1978.
Whoa.
You were not allowed to homebrew until the late 70s. And in fact, that was nationwide. But in Texas, they gave it a couple more years. You weren't allowed to homebrew in Texas until 1983.
Oh,
and by that time, a household of the craft beer names we know today were already starting. Ankerstein Brewing Company, Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, Boston Brewing Company. you know, North Texas did actually play a pivotal role in beer history because mm-hmm. Miller Brewing Company, mm-hmm. the first place they ever brewed Miller Lite in 1975 was in Fort Worth.
Cool.
Yeah.
That was my brand in college.
Yeah. Well, think about this. Fort Worth essentially jump-started the light beer revolution. And so that's like my little fun fact for people in like beer history. You know, Troy Aikman the other day, I interviewed him for a story. And I was like, what's your beer? And he was like, Miller Lite. And I was like, that was a stupid answer. But but every time someone does that, I'm like, well, it is a local beer. And that is something we should be proud of. So, but still, you know, small batch or craft brewing didn't take off until the 90s. There was this brewpub movement. In 1993, brewpubs were made legal finally.
Cool.
The whole, like, it can be a brewery, press a restaurant, but
Oh, yeah, I totally remember that starting to be a thing.
Yeah. The momentum was really short-lived, though, because drinkers in Texas weren't educated about beer, and so there was really no thirsty population to support them. So that sort of died off. And then the early 2000s, the last 5 to 10 years, I mean, craft beer has just exploded. It's a viable multi-billion dollar industry, and of course it's made waves in Texas. So that's how we got here.
Yeah.
It was a long and storied journey, but I'm sure wine has some sort of epic history here.
Girl, let me tell you, it starts even earlier, actually, in your cute little story. No, I'm just kidding. but the first records we found of wine being made in Texas was from around El Paso, related to the Spanish missionaries, and that was around 1650. So the super cool thing about that, let me dust shoulders off, is that it was almost 100 years earlier than California was planting their grapes. Yeah. So, and I mentioned in the first episode, Father Junipero Serra.
What is his name?
Junipero Serra.
Nailed it.
Perfect. You know, in the 1760s was one of the missionaries out there, you know, priests planting. And they were all planning for sacramental wine to use as Eucharist for their services. So
yeah, so follow Jesus, you'll find the
really,
wine.
Really, yeah. Just like in other parts of Europe, the spread of wine is really, you know, related back to religion spreading as well. And then, you know, it slowly started to take hold. People were brewing in their homes, and just like all other cool things in life, Prohibition pretty much decimated that and ruined everything.
Yeah.
And again, they didn't see a revival with winemaking in America until the 70s, which is when things in California started to really kick off. But it was marked by the founding of Llano Estacado and Pheasant Ridge Wineries in the High Plains, AVA, American Viticultural Area.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that after Prohibition, it took the entire booze business that long to recover. 40 years, it seems like, because homebrewing and new breweries didn't come around until the 70s. And sounds like that's similar with wine,
totally.
At least in Texas. Gosh, the Bible Belt will keep that shit out.
I know. All those. And I was reading something, too. I can't find the notes here, but it was like something like 240 counties in Texas right now still are under laws
still
from like the Prohibition.
Dry.
Yeah, related to that, which I think is crazy time.
It is. What? How many business opportunities are they losing by doing that?
Yeah, or like really, like I said in I think maybe another episode, Texas could really be like a wine destination.
Yeah.
Fredericksburg is all the rage. The High Plains, and I think it'll only get more so in the next 50 to 80 years. And we're really just doing ourselves a disservice by not allowing our people to like embrace that culture.
Yeah. Well, this is a subject for another podcast, but the reasons why, the laws, we'll get a little bit into the laws, but laws, religion, taboo, the whole shebang. Yeah.
Well,
we're going to come back to Texas.
Well.
And I mean, you literally, because.
Yeah. I'm moving to Australia.
Oh my God, breaking news.
Yeah.
Laura is moving to Australia, but she'll be back.
I am. I'm only going for 6 to 7 months, and I will be back soon. So no worries about that. I'll get some good interviews from some amazing winemakers in Australia and New Zealand while I'm there.
Just going to go get drunk and pick hops. And
Yes, I'm going to do all the things.
I'm going to miss you. This one's
for
you.
Cheers.
All right, back to wine.
So, you know, girl, I always get so excited when T.V. Munson's name comes up.
Love T.V. Munson.
My historical crush. So you can't talk about Texas wine history without talking about T.V. Munson. And while he wasn't a Texas-born native, he was a super influential import, if you will. What's the name for that with people?
Importer?
No, when people move in. Immigrant?
No, import. No, immigrant.
Yeah.
I was thinking expat.
Anyways,
expat is the opposite.
He moved here. He's an amazing contribution to our great state.
Honorary Texan.
Yes. So he's was pretty hoss. He for 30 years he traveled. So around from 1880 to 1910, he traveled over 50,000 miles by horse, by train, by foot.
Oh my God!
Through all the, I don't know, not all of them, but like, I don't know, 40 states or so, and making incredibly detailed and descriptive drawings and notes on over 1,000 native vine species through the U.S., which no one had really done or classified or collected that kind of vast number of amount of information on it before.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so his work is considered like a standard.
Like the first wine encyclopedia.
Yeah, used by, you know, the Survey Society and all this stuff. And what's really cool, too, is he had a nursery and he ran out of, with or his two brothers lived in Denison as well and his wife. And so he ran a nursery out of there. And so I go to school at the T.V. Munson building of Grayson College.
Uh-huh.
And one of the last times I was there in class, they actually had like the old timey, like yellowed paper. We got to take it out and look at it. Catalog for his nursery.
Oh man.
Yeah.
For so what he was personally growing?
Yeah, it was like over 100-year-old little thing.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
So it was super neat.
Is your school a museum too? I'm sure there's a museum.
So there's a lot of like historical things at the school, but his home in Denison has also been converted to a museum for him. So I want to go in.
Tourist alert.
Yeah. If you're going out to drink at Iron Root, make sure you stop by the T.V. Munson Museum. And I guess I am not the I almost missed the most important part. He saved, like, French wine with his phylloxera-resistant rootstock, which we've mentioned before. But I'm not the only person who has a super history crush on this guy. The A&M research paper I was reading, you have to listen to this description. This person was crushing so hard.
Who, the person who wrote the paper?
Yes.
Okay.
Listen to his description of T.V. Munson. Munson, the man, was truly an outstanding individual. He was highly intelligent, extremely motivated, and physically strong. Munson was a deep thinker. And,
so and a total babe.
A total babe. I just thought that was such a hilarious description of this person in like a research paper.
Oh my gosh, absolutely.
Oh, but now, yeah, to bring it history back up to the present day, Texas is currently the fourth largest wine-producing state in the nation, which I don't know if you're...
Is that true?
It is.
That's a great little tidbit because you don't... Nobody puts Texas wine up there with, like, the big players.
They don't. So California, obviously, is number one. New York, two. Washington, three. We've talked about Washington quite a bit, too. And so Texas, yeah, number four. And we don't produce a lot of the wine here, but a lot of it is, like, grown and sold to larger producers.
Like vintners that live elsewhere?
Kind of, yeah.
Or well, the other way around, like we're buying stuff.
No, people, other people are buying our stuff, mass produced and sent other. So, but I feel like that's kind of what happens in other regions. And then people start getting really proud of where they're from. And then enough time passes and people get good at it.
Yeah. And there's a robust wine industry here too.
Yeah,
like you can go to the store and there's a Texas selection of wine.
I went to the Texas section of Whole Foods to get this wine. Whole Foods, shout out. Hashtag sponsor me. the fourth largest. We have over 200 wineries across the state, and we produce roughly 4,000 tons of wine every year. And the largest producer, actually landowner, I guess, of grapes is the University of Texas.
Whoa.
Yeah, they started bought up a ton, I guess, in the 70s initially as experimental vineyards, and now Bordeaux groups and like St. Genevieve wine and all these other labels.
That's interesting because A&M is really the agriculture.
So A&M, I was like, yeah, I'm not really, I wish I could do more research. That could be a whole nother episode, honestly. We got to watch a video of this interview with a Denison man who was a professor at Texas University, University of Texas, I would love to dig more into that as well, and A&M and the in Lubbock now too. Mm-hmm. All this like Texas school competition with the wine.
Yeah, Longhorn wine. Like, why isn't that a thing?
So yeah, and then Alano Estacado is the second largest. And do you remember that's out by Lubbock? Do you remember one of the first couple episodes I mentioned that I had stomped grapes before, and you were like, "Fancy, oh Lubbock." Well, this is where Alano Estacado, Yano, I should say. I'm going to send emails. Yano Estacado.
Amarillo.
Bye,
Amarillo.
So, yeah, that's just a little rundown on wine history.
Awesome. Yeah. So when you talk about where wine originated, are those still the regions that are the big players to this day?
That is a great question. So, yes-ish. So the biggest wine producing region within, well, I'll just start and say there are 8 AVA's recognized American viticulture areas in Texas. Bell Mountain, Texoma, which is a pretty decent sized one, Texas Davis Mountains, Escondido. But the 3 probably most well-known and highest producing are the Texas High Plains, which the Texas High Plains is located near Amarillo. And Borger, Texas, and, up by the Panhandle. Halfway up the Panhandle in the west, and that produces the most grapes out of Texas. Okay. And yeah, is
what
also
kind of grapes?
I believe white ones are really so. There's 36 varieties of grapes grown and sold out of Texas, and about 12 of them might be native to Texas. Don't quote me the dead on that, but I'm pretty sure. So the really popular ones kicking off were like Cabernet and Sauvignon and Chardonnay, because we were trying to be California. We didn't come into our own yet. Mm-hmm. But now it's a lot of white wines like Gewurztraminer and Riesling and some of this Tempranillo and other ones we've talked about too.
Cool.
So yeah, so that's Texas High Plains. The other super big, the second largest actually, is Texas Hill Country, which is my personal favorite. Mm-hmm. I love going to Texas Hill Country.
It's so beautiful down there.
It's so stinking beautiful.
Even without the vineyards, it's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like Texas.
The camping, the drive, even if you just drive through there, the food.
Absolutely. There's like deer and stuff.
Ugh, so great. And then there's a little pocket in there inside of Texas Hill Country called Fredericksburg, which we mentioned at the beginning of the episode as a wine destination. For Texas. But yeah, does beer work the same way? Is there like important Texas regions of beer? You can't grow beer.
You cannot grow beer.
Beer grapes here.
Beer does not grow on trees, unfortunately. The important regions, and it's funny you mentioned Fredericksburg because that was German.
There it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
German hotspot back in the day. But the important and major player regions for beer are more closer to the city centers because these are highly manufactured products. So you need tons of manufacturing. You need warehouse space. You need access to roads and highways so that you can get your raw materials and distribute your beer. So, and then also the tourism. So beer tourism is one of the sort of like the support beams of the beer industry now as more people get into beer and go and visit these small businesses. So Austin, Houston, and Dallas-Fort Worth are really the big players when it comes to Texas beer just because of all of those things. So
awesome.
Austin is known as the beer tourism hub at the moment, and that's because it was one of the first places to blossom in the modern movement. Mm. I interviewed this man.
It's really just got their first kind of thing.
Well, I think it was just people being hip to the movement.
Hip to movement people definitely do it in Austin.
I interviewed this guy. His name's Davis Tucker, and every year he does a bike pilgrimage from Austin, Texas to Denver for the Great American Beer Festival. And in the process of interviewing him, the bike portion of this has like a really great cause associated to it. But he's really into beer because he was one of the first people to start making a quote unquote craft product and distributing it. So that was in the late 80s is when he started his business. And then eventually it fizzled out because, there just wasn't that much interest. Mm-hmm. But today Austin is home to many award winning breweries. The Austin Beer Garden and Brewery has won Large Brew Pub of the Year at Great American Beer Festival 2017 and 2016.
Oh, nice.
They make really great beers. Obviously, it's full of innovators like Jester King who are pushing the envelope. Mm-hmm. And so people love going there. But Houston also has a lot of breweries popping up and winning awards. St. Arnold Brewing Company is one of the oldest craft breweries in the state, celebrating 24 years this year. Hmm. And that'll tell you a lot about the movement here in and of itself, that one of our oldest breweries, besides Shiner, obviously, but yeah. One of our oldest breweries is only a couple of decades old.
Yeah, totally.
And then DFW, I would say, is probably pulling ranks with regard to tenure and prestige, but there's still a ton of really exciting stuff going on up here. And I've been really fortunate to be able to watch the scene grow from 2010, when we had less than 10 beer manufacturers. Now there are more than 60.
Wow.
And DFW is unique because it's not isolated. The scenes are not isolated to Fort Worth, Dallas, and Denton. Mm. Because there are so many suburbs, a lot of these breweries are allowed to get into the community, have the small communities bolster them, and really become part of life in the suburbs. So.
Very cool. Man, it's really impressive all these places are thriving around our city and in Texas, because from my impression and understanding is Texas has been one of the most notoriously strict and regulated states as far as, I mean, I always ask, like, why can't I get that alcohol I like here? Why can't I get that spirit I like here? It's always like the import laws are this, like the hoops you have to jump through for that, the distribution, it's pretty sticky to navigate.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting because beer and wine, it's a lot of like fun and learning new things. But if there's one thing, and I've said this before, but if there's one thing you need to know, if you're going to be operating any sort of business with any sort of touch on alcohol in Texas, is you're going to have to deal with the TABC. And that's the Texas Alcohol and Beverage Commission. And they have been cracking down on all the drinks for so long. Basically, all of our modern booze legislation is patchwork to undo prohibition. And it varies so widely from what's allowed for breweries to do versus wineries versus distilleries.
Oh,
you're allowed to buy, where you're allowed to buy them, when you're allowed to buy them.
Oh, my gosh. The wind. That's so funny you mentioned that, because even today when I was picking up this Texas wine for a What You Drinkin' segment, I love to get a little whiskey kickback for our audio engineer over here at Jack and Dorothy Studios.
Yes. Shout out to Jack and Dorothy Studios.
Yes. But it was a Sunday, and not to mention it was like before 10 a.m. Whiskey for you. So he is on his What You Drinkin' segment. I brought him a Real Ale Fireman's Four from Blanco, Texas, which was one of my personal Texas.
I will put the fire out with that.
Excellent. Well, yeah, it varies so widely. The Sunday thing has always just sort of been a thorn in my side because it's just inconvenient.
Dang, I just wanted to have a screwmosa by the pool. Kill me.
But even when it comes to just beer, like, things are so fractured and convoluted. So there's actually a difference in the TABC code between beer and ale. So beer is anything that is less than 5% alcohol by volume. And ale is classified as everything above 5% alcohol by volume.
That's interesting. There's a similar law in wine with 24% either being wine or like fortified wine.
Oh, interesting.
And it's like what you can do with it, where you can send it, how you can use it. Just like, boom, all of a sudden they're different.
Well, this refers to what you can and cannot make. So if you want to make beers that are 3% to 12%, you need two different permits, which is just crazy. And you have to express that on the label, too. Mm. So a lot of this has to do with labeling, but
really?
Yeah. Something that is unique to the beer manufacturing industry as well is this law. It's basically what people are calling it is like the no six-pack law. Because if you're a brew pub or you're a winery, and this is all by like what it says on your permit. If you're a brew pub, if you're a winery, if you're a distillery, you're allowed to sell the products that you manufacture to go. But if you are a brewery, you can't do that.
That's so interesting.
If you have a brewery permit, I can walk into your brewery and I can buy glasses of beer there. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's only a recent phenomenon, only since 2013.
Yeah.
So I can buy a pint there, but I can't buy a six-pack of that beer or a growler of that beer to go.
Mm.
And it's basically because what a lot of the conflicts between the beer laws are sort of weighing the pros and cons against the distributor. So Texas has this thing known as the three-tier system, which means there are manufacturers, retailers, and distributors. And those three parties have to be involved in every alcoholic transaction. So the distributors don't like if a brewery is allowed to sell beer to go from their tap room, then the distributor's not getting their cut. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the craft brewers are very out of favor with the people who run our state because they believe that they are in the pockets of the distributors, which is why a lot of
There's been some restaffing of the TABC in the last year or two.
So that's something that's uniquely beer related because you can go to a winery and buy a bottle to go.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? So there is a permit, too, that winemakers need as well. It's called the G permit. And we actually did a whole segment in one of our classes about it at Grayson. And, you know, that's only if you're like... But you can do a lot with it. You really can. You can manufacture it. You can bottle. You can label, even if you're not, you know, making the wine itself. It can't be more than 24%, like I mentioned. But then, yeah, you can take that. You can take sell it to wholesalers, to any wineries, other wineries, competitors, straight into consumers and in unbroken packages. And they can take it away. It's so crazy. It's pretty broad, honestly. But I don't know. Like I said, I hope it keeps moving in that way. I like the direction that's going in, so hopefully both of us will get swept in the the tide.
Well, let's talk a minute about Open Container, because this is another place where winos get sort of a pass legally Container.
Well, typically it's a... I don't know why is that. Do you think that has to do with, like, the connotation with drinkers of, like, those substances?
No, I think it has to do with industry lobbyists. Oh. Like, the wine lobbyists went to the legislators and were like, hey, we want this for our community. Here's why it's a good idea. And the distilleries and the breweries never went and do that, and not that they would ever get a pass to do it now. But that's part of why the laws are so fractured is because each individual manufacturing type is going and lobbying on behalf of its interests, not booze production as a whole in the state.
Yeah.
So, okay, I found this really funny because we went there for a long time. I've been hearing rumors about what exactly is an open container. Obviously, if you have a half-empty beer in your car with no top, drop top. or like you're drinking an open glass of wine or something. But this is technically the law because for a long time we've heard like if you only have four beers in your six pack of beer, that's open container or something like that. And I had to research this because I thought maybe that was bullshit and like an old wives' tale. It's totally true.
Are you serious?
Well, it doesn't explicitly say that, but listen to this definition.
Okay.
So by the TABC code, an open container means a bottle, can, or other receptacle that contains any amount of alcoholic beverage that is open, has been open, that has a broken seal, or the contents of which are partially removed. So if you have a six-pack of beer and there are only four of them in there, then the contents have been partially removed.
Now, is that only for beer specifically, that law?
No. Where's that? That's the entire open container law.
Oh, well, okay, so wine, you open a bottle of wine, and there's plenty of restaurants. You just slap a cork back in that puppy, and you take it with you, and that is fine. Although, I guess it really depends on, and then, like, the, you know, places with wine on tap, too. You can
fill growlers.
Yeah.
If they're not selling spirits, they can sell beer or wine to go, and that's true for beer as well, but only if you're a brew pub.
So, yeah, some restaurants will stick it in a bag and seal it. Maybe that's, like, a little more sealed. But, yeah, maybe – I don't know. It's crazy. I don't know why that is.
It's very odd. Yeah, wine gets a pass. It's like you're allowed to – you cannot take a half glass of anything out the door unless it's wine in a bottle.
Unless it's a whole bottle of wine. Enjoy that. Good luck tonight.
We must not waste the wine.
Yeah, wild. So
Let's take a quick break. Or did you have anything else to add on the subject?
Nope, that was it.
All right, cool. Well, let's take a quick break, and then Laura and I are going to dive into some of our favorite wineries and breweries from Dallas-Fort Worth.
Sweet.
So,
that sounds awesome. I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, I need to refill.
Awesome.
Cheers.
Well, speaking of Texas, I'd love to share a little bit about a new winery opening this fall in North Texas. My friend and classmate Jeanette Fitzgerald is opening a place called Fitzel Winery, and I'm super excited about it. Fitzel Winery will have a vineyard and tasting room, her son will be running a food truck and a restaurant on property, and they'll have a great family area full of games and entertainment. It's going to be awesome. Here's Jeanette with a word on what we can expect.
I have just planted my Tempranillo on my Riesling. It's all in the ground now. Should be at least 3 years before the grapes are ready for harvest. However, in the meantime, I will be going out to different wineries across the state and looking for some that I just think are good wines, and I'll be serving those. So that's my plan, and eventually we will open a full restaurant and have that to go along with the winery and serve wine, and we're hoping that we get the wine cart up by this fall, if not sooner, and the food truck probably in the next couple of months so that people can start knowing where we are and come having some great food.
Wow. That sounds great. Can't wait to see it soon. Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast.
If you are a retailer or a producer and would like to sponsor us or have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment, drop us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain, at gmail.com.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Sounds fun. Does Robert give them?
He did. He gave ours. I don't know if he's the one every time. We are special VIP coming from the school. You know how that is.
All right. Well, yeah. We're going to come back from a commercial break.
So we talked about the history of beer and wine in Texas. We talked about the popular areas, mm-hmm. the players, the laws.
The laws, yeah. That was a lot of dense source material.
It
so.
Really was. Let's lighten it up. We saved the best for last year. Tell me about some of your favorite Texas producers. What do they
yeah.
have going on?
Well, Jester King, who I mentioned at the beginning, is definitely a Texas favorite.
So cool.
What they do is just so unique, and I cannot wait to see where they go with their new vineyard and the farm that they're opening. But if we're talking Dallas-Fort Worth, my go-to beer is the Community Beer Company Mosaic IPA.
So good.
Yeah.
Is that what you just opened over there?
Yes. Hopefully you guys heard that. It was a nice snap, crackle, pop.
Yeah. I love the smell of that one. And it is honestly so tasty.
Yeah. Well, as the name suggests, it uses predominantly Mosaic hops. Mm. It's a beautiful amber beer. I would call it burnt orange, but that's not in the vernacular, the approved vernacular. And it's a... got a really great malt backbone, too. So I actually forgot that this is not an easy it is an easy drinking beer for me, but it packs a punch. I had four the other day, and I woke up with a hangover, and I was like, what is going on? This beer is 8% alcohol each. So it is not a small beer by any means, but it's incredibly balanced. It won't weigh you down. Just really beautiful beer.
No, just knock you down 2-1.
But it'll catch you. It'll catch you
and
when
it's
you fall.
Soft, hoppy hands.
Laura, what's one of your favorite local wineries or Texas varietals at the moment?
Yeah, totally. So we talked about the High Plains. It's one of the largest producers producing AVAs in Texas. And I've had one recently from Lost Oak. It was a Tempranillo. It was delicious. So it was at that planting party I went to. And
tell us about the planting party.
Yeah, so one of the gals from class has opening a vineyard, and we planted Riesling and Tempranillo vines. And because it takes 35 years for the wine to happen, she had
so
a different the varieties, but from a different producer. So she served us Lost Oak Tempranillo. And because of the warm days and the cool nights out there, which some people say is similar to regions in Spain, it gets a really great heavy taste of dark cherries, and the oakiness gives it this leather. And they're also fermented in micro bins, just kind of like out and about too, but I think they add a little yeast too. But then it's aged 10 months in American oak, so it gives it all that, like we talked about, that leathery, oaky character. Oh, yeah. So it was a pretty, like, big and bold wine, I thought, which was really delicious.
What about whites? Are there any, like, Texas whites that you like?
Yeah, dude, surprisingly, there's quite a bit. So Dukeman, which is a producer, they do a really good, Trebbiano grape, Vermentino grape, and Viognier is a pretty big one. I think from Pedernales, they have a really good
Pedernales.
Viognier.
It's a hill country.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly. So, there's a couple people on growing Sauvignon Blanc, but it's more of those Viognier style grapes, I guess. But the red wine you see quite a bit is a Tempranillo, some Cabernet Sauvignon like I have today from Becker, which is a pretty big producer in Texas. you know, decent stuff. What was the brewery you just said?
Community?
Community. Oh, no. You know what I was thinking of? I'm sorry. I was thinking of that Real Ale, because from Real Ale, they did the Fireman's Four, but I really like their Lost Gold IPA when that mm-hmm. was a thing that came around quite a bit, too.
Yeah, it was good. It's one of their solid brands, and Real Ale is based in Blanco, which is a smaller city outside of San Antonio with a really robust booze scene. So yeah. They're making some whiskey like you said, down
Dripping
there.
Springs, and yeah, because that vodka, they've sponsored our tailgating spot of SMU 1 year.
That's awesome. Well, but if I were, so the Hill Country is a great place to go booze hopping. They call Dripping Springs, the nickname is Drinking Springs, which is really fun. I went and did a tour down there recently, but if I were telling someone to come to Dallas-Fort Worth, I would probably send them to Community, and then another brewery called Peticolis Brewing Company. So Peticolis isn't actually the same neighborhood as Community, and they opened it around similar times. But Peticolis has been known as like one of the most high quality producers of beer around DFW. And they just really started with a solid lineup, and it's always executed well. Their beers have personality. Their Velvet Hammer is the stuff of local legend, and they call it the Velvet Hammer because it's a red ale and mouthfeel is very velvety, but you can drink some of those and the next day you'll feel like you got hit by a hammer because they're 9% each. So it's another one of these beers where, you know, it's so good tasting, but be careful.
Totally. That's kind of true of Texas wine, too, especially in the warmer regions. It's higher sugar, which turns into, like, more alcohol after fermentation, so.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, yeah, Texans, you know, it's the way we do it, I guess.
Where is one bucket list place in Texas for wine that you would like to go to?
You know, I still haven't been to Fredericksburg.
You haven't?
No,
haven't. Okay, we need to make this a thing.
Oh, yeah, so that would be it for sure, although I'd like to go out to El Paso, too, and see some more of that original vines are going. I'm a big history buff, and I love Texas history, too, especially.
I've never been to El Paso.
I have. I've camped through it a couple times. That desert camping is my favorite out in West Texas. But, yeah, what about you? Any, what's, like, a, like, I would love to go to, like, Blanco, to Real Ale. Is there any, like, destination wine, or, excuse me, beer hotspot in Texas you haven't made it to yet?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Austin. I recently went down there for a story that I wrote that ran in the travel section of the Dallas Morning News about where to go in Austin, and had the great pleasure of brewery hopping and a distillery hopping, Dripping Springs, Austin. I would love to revisit that scene, but in general, I would love to go to Houston. You know, Houston has been is battling back from the hurricane that devastated everything, including, you know, homes, manufacturing, businesses. I feel like Houston, for as long as I've lived in Texas, I have not gone down and experienced Houston. And I would love to see St. Arnold and really go contribute my dollars to that economy.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I'll totally go down with you. My stepsister lives there with her family. Haven't seen him forever. And I would love to put some, like you said, dollars back into that economy down there.
All right, our great home state.
Yeah.
Party at Sarah's. Party at Laura's sister-in-law's house.
Yeah. well, shoot, man, I'll cheers to that.
Yeah.
Cheers. All right, be sure to follow us on social media, Grapes of Grain Podcast _ between every word on Instagram, and send us your listener mail. Tell us what you want to hear. If you want to challenge something, throw it on the gauntlet.
Yeah, throw it on the gauntlet.
Send that too.
Just don't challenge us to drink less.
Yeah. Or more. We're grown-ups women, so we'll be as responsible as we want to be.
All right. Thank you, guys. Be sure to check out our blog for extra features, audio, pictures, more details about our lives.
Recipes, too.
Ooh, recipes.
Upcoming recipe with the next episode.
Ooh. Y'all stay tuned. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured in our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
Absolutely. We love to hear from listeners and share fun stories and answer any random questions we get. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Find us on Instagram at grapesandgrainpodcasts _ between each word, and just search for Grapes and Grain Podcasts on Facebook.
Remember, that's grapes, plural, grain, singular. You can also find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.wordpress.com to see blog posts that go more in-depth to each episode. You can also download or stream our podcast there and find lots of other content about beer and wine.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today.
Cheers!
What you drinking?